Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. To learn more about Allowed and how you can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The program you're about to hear from the Allowed Archives was produced in 1999.
Good afternoon. My name is Terry Wolverton, and I'm delighted to welcome you to The Big Questions. I'm so relieved that there are people who are dealing with the big questions. My idea of a big question is soy milk or rice dream? Louise Steinman, who organized this series, has asked me to remind you that there are two more events left in the series, the poet Robert Pinsky and the performance artist Laurie Anderson. So check it out. Get your tickets before you leave. I want to tell you a little bit about the format for today. I'm going to introduce Bell Hooks. Bell is going to speak to you, and then she's going to take questions directly from you. So as you're listening to her, you should be thinking about your own big questions and be ready to pose them. In her 1999 book, Remembered Rapture, The Writer at Work, Bell Hooks writes, "When I was a little girl longing to be a writer, the writer whose work touched my soul, reaching into the innermost places where much within me had gone unrecognized and unloved, was Emily Dickinson. Even though I had my card game Authors, which gave me a visual portrait of her, I never saw her as a white woman. Reading her work, I never thought about race. Inside, she lived unbounded. She lived in service to the imagination. She had surrendered. That was the mark of the great writer, the willingness to surrender to the power of the imagination." Bell Hooks was born Gloria Jean Watkins in 1952. She grew up in rural Kentucky. She was born, as are we all, into a world where race, gender, and class profoundly affect one's capacity and opportunity to express the power of the imagination. In her 17 books, 17, that's right, whose titles include Ain't I a Woman, Black Women and Feminism, Outlaw Culture, Resisting Representations, and Killing Rage, Ending Racism, she has articulated with a fierce eloquence a vision of liberation that addresses the multiple layers of oppression that bind and restrict the expression of full humanity. In those 17 books, she has directed her attention toward an awe-inspiring range of subject matter, not only issues of African-American identity, feminism, and the struggle for liberation, but also contemporary culture, including film, music, literature, and the visual arts, spirituality, coming from a tradition of Christianity, she is now a practicing Buddhist, education, and the chronicling of her own experience growing up Black, female, and working class in the rural South. It is not only the keen intellect to which we are drawn in the work of Bell Hooks, but the expansiveness of spirit. in her book, Teaching to Transgress, Education as the Practice of Freedom, she exhorts teachers to believe that there is an aspect of our vocation that is sacred. Believe that our work is not merely to share information, but to share in the intellectual and spiritual growth of our students. To teach in a manner that respects and cares for the souls of our students. Bell Hooks is a theorist who acknowledges the soul, an intellectual who is not afraid to reveal her own experience as the basis for analysis. Perhaps it is this commitment to authenticity, to self-examination and self-actualizing, the demonstration that she walks her talk, that is most compelling in the work of Bell Hooks. In her latest book, All About Love, New Visions, Bell Hooks once again draws on her personal experience to examine this most pervasive and mystifying of forces. The exploration will be the foundation of her presentation today as she addresses the big question, why choose to love? Please join me in a warm welcome for Bell Hooks.
In fact, when Louise called me to ask me to come here, one of the reasons that I was quite happy to say yes, I think I'm going to take this down so I can look at all different sides of people who are here. The people who are up in the balcony and people who are down a little lower, was that I was already grappling with this one big question about love. And it's already started to happen that when I go and I talk a little bit about the question of love, people will start saying to me, oh, I hope you're not going to lose that, you know, critical edge, that daring, you know, like angry voice that we had in all the other writings. And I say to them that that's exactly what I think about the question of love, that to talk about love and to talk about the big question of why choose love and why our nation has to choose love again as one of the ethical values driving our daily lives is in fact to be doing that which is courageous and daring and enormously difficult to do, precisely because of the profound trivialization of love in our culture. The fact that so many people, feel like that it's a soft subject. You know, talking about race and gender, now that's hard, that's provocative, that's biting. But in fact, when I wrote Yearning years ago, one of the things I said at the beginning of that book, and it's one of my favorite books, is that that space cross everything, race, sexual preference, practice. There are seats up front if you just want to come in, sweetie, it's fine. And the woman behind you, too, there's a seat here. That's sort of what I argued at the beginning of Yearning was that we might do well to not just problematize our difficulties around race, gender and other things, but to also then talk about what brings us together. You know, what kinds of yearnings do we share across all of those things? And it seems to me that the desire to love and be loved is one of those yearnings people share, irrespective of class, race, sexual preference, practice, and that it might be interesting for us to theorize in terms of our struggles to end all forms of domination from that place of love. And Louise caught me at a moment when, in fact, my own thinking about this big question was in terms of thinking about the millennia, thinking about our planet, about how much we've done to end domination and how much we haven't been able to do. and to be able to think about where has love been in that discourse? Where has it been in our struggles? And I'm going to read you the preface to the new book, which I passed out little bits of it as by way of advertisement of my new little book. When I was a child, it was clear to me that life was not worth living if we did not know love. I wish I could testify that I came to this awareness because of the love I felt in my life. But it was love's absence that let me know how much love mattered. I was my father's first daughter. At the moment of my birth, I was looked upon with loving kindness, cherished, and made to feel wanted in this earth and on my home. And in my home. To this day, I can't remember when that feeling of being loved left me. I just know that one day I was no longer precious. Those who had loved me well initially turned away. The absence of their recognition and regard pierced my heart and left me with a feeling of brokenheartedness so profound I was spellbound. Grief and sadness overwhelmed me. I didn't know what I had done wrong, and nothing I tried made it right. No other connection healed the hurt of that first abandonment, that first banishment from love's paradise. For years, I lived my life suspended, trapped by the past, unable to move into the future. Like every wounded child, I just wanted to turn back time and be in that paradise again, in that moment of remembered rapture where I felt loved, where I felt a sense of belonging. We can never go back, I know that now. We can go forward, we can find the heart, the love our hearts long for, but not until we let go grief about the love we lost long ago when we were little and had no voice to speak the heart's learning. All the years of my life, I thought I was searching for love. I found retrospectively to be years where I was simply trying to recover what I had lost, trying to return to the first home, to get back the rapture of first love. I was not really ready to be loved in the present. I was still mourning, clinging to the broken heart of girlhood, to broken connections. When that mourning ceased, I was able to love again. And I talk about this because my reentry into the world of searching for love and talking to people about love really raised again that big question of why choose love. Because as I began to talk to people about love, so many people said to me, "Oh, girl, you're not interested in love." My sister said, "Oh, you don't want a husband, girl. If you had one, you'd be trying to get rid of him like we're trying to do with the ones we have." You know? But the deepest thing for me was when I talked to young people, and particularly I marked my interview with the little porn rapper, Lil' Kim, as a turning point for me in thinking about love, because we had been talking about, you know, rap and all the different things, and at one point I said to her, "What about love?" And then this is a few years ago, and she said to me, "Love, what's that? I've never known any love." And suddenly it just hit me that here was a nation where this young black woman could come from a dysfunctional, poor family, and she could aspire to be a multimillionaire before the age of 30 and potentially reach that goal. But she could have no sense that within her life she might know love, that she might have a sense of what love is, and therefore, as you know, if she doesn't know love, then she's not going to be able to give love to others. And so this really, really, really moved me deep in my heart. I felt such a sense of sorrow. And also, but as always, I theorize from the personal into the collective. I thought, well, what does it mean to live in a nation that can make it possible, despite racism, despite sexism, despite class oppression, for poor young people to play basketball and become multimillionaires before they're, you know, the age of 40, to do certain forms of music and become multimillionaires, but that culture still does not make a place where those people can begin to know love. And I think that one of the the profound brilliances of Gloria Steinem's books, Revolution from Within, was that she pointed out that when you raise a nation of successful people who are still mired in self-hatred, those powerful and successful people, though they may have money and success, may also do grave harm to people, the people they work with, the planet, etc., because underneath all of those trappings is that wounded voice saying, love, what's that? I don't know anything about love. In Terry's book, and I thank Terry for introducing me, and I urge you, if you don't know her work, to read it, but also the collections of writings about AIDS, there's a marvelous introduction that she writes where she says in one paragraph there that we never imagined love would be like this. And in many ways, in my own writing about love, I've tried to get at that reimagination of love, a vision of love that might take us from that sense of the love that hurts, the love that does not ensure our survival, or the love that does not ensure that we can die recognized, known. You know, every day in our life, people are dying of AIDS somewhere whose family refuse to recognize them, who refuse to honor their life with the acknowledgement of their worth and their value. I want to just read a little bit, and then we have lots of time for questions. This is a piece that I wanted to work on in terms of thinking about the relationship between why choose love and human community. And part of what I want to theorize with you today is when we do not choose love, it does not change the fact that our existence on this planet is one of interdependency. I had the marvelous occasion a few weeks ago to interview Thich Nhat Hanh, the Buddhist teacher who's affected my work so much. And one of the things that we talked about was this question of how to interest people in choosing love and in interdependency in a world where we can't get away from our interdependency and our interconnectedness. At the same time, what we spend so much of our time doing is violating that interdependency and that interconnectedness. To ensure human survival, everywhere in the world, females and males organize themselves into communities. Communities sustain life. This is my answer to the question of why choose love. Communities sustain life, not nuclear families, not the couple, and certainly not the rugged individualists. There is no better place to learn the art of loving than in community. M. Scott Peck begins his book, A Different Drum, Community Making and Peace, with the profound declaration, in and through community lies the salvation of the world. Peck defines community as the coming together of a group of individuals, quote, who have learned how to communicate honestly with each other, whose relationships go deeper than their mask of composure, and who have developed some significant commitment to rejoice together, mourn together, and to delight in each other, and make other conditions our own. I think that's such a beautiful description of community. We're all born into the world of community. Rarely, if ever, does a child come into the world in isolation with only one or two onlookers. There are usually other witnesses present, people whom we are connected to by blood and kinship, as well as strangers. Children are born into the world surrounded by the possibility of communities. Families, doctors, nurses, midwives, and even admiring strangers make up this field of connections, some more intimate than others. Much of the talk about family values in our society highlights the nuclear family, one that's made up of mother, father, and preferably only one or two children. In the United States, this unit is presented as the primary and preferable organization for the parenting of children, one that will ensure everyone's optimal well-being. Of course, everyone knows this is a fantasy image of family. Hardly anyone in our society lives in an environment like this. Even individuals who are raised in nuclear families usually experience it as merely a smaller unit within a larger unit of extended kin. And I go on in these pages to talk about the failure of the patriarchal nuclear family to teach us how to choose love. And then I say here, the privatized patriarchal nuclear family is still a fairly new form of social organization in the world. Given the world's swiftly dwindling resources, the vast majority of people do not have and will never have the material resources to live segregated from family communities into small units. Even in the United States, studies show that economic factors, the high cost of housing and unemployment, are creating a cultural climate where grown children are leaving the family home at a later stage and frequently returning or never leaving. I remember, like my own mother and father, like we rented this old rambling house, and when we were all gone, they bought this little two-bedroom tiny house that they thought they were going to retire and have this peaceful life in. And at every step of the way, there has been some child or some grandchild or a whole combination of people there in that house with them because of, one, economic circumstances. Second, the ravages of addiction where people lose complete control over their lives. The extended family is a good place to learn the power of community. However, it can only become a community if there's honest combination between individuals who comprise that family. If we don't experience love in our extended families of origins, which is the first site for community offered us, the other place where children have the opportunity to build community and know love is in friendship. Since we choose our friends, many of us from childhood on into our adulthood, we look to friends for the care, respect, knowledge, and all-around nurturance of our growth we don't find in families. Writing in her moving memoir, Never Let Me Down, Susan Miller recalls, "I kept thinking, love must be here somewhere. I looked and looked inside myself, but I couldn't find it. I knew what love was. It was the feeling I had with my dolls, for beautiful things, for certain friends. Later on, when I knew Debbie, my best friend, I felt even more sure that love was what made you feel good. Love was not what made you feel bad, hate yourself. It was what comforted you, freed you up inside, made you laugh. Sometimes Debbie and I would fight, but that was different because we were basically, essentially connected. Loving friendships provide a space for us to experience the joy of community in a relationship where we learn to process, to cope with differences and conflict while staying connected." And I go on in this particular writing to talk about how often the myth of romantic love as being the only love that matters leads many of us to portray the power of love in friendship. And I give examples of this, but most importantly, I say trust is the heartbeat of genuine love. And we trust that the attention we give to partners and that we give to friends does not take anything away from us, that we're not diminished. What we learn through experience is that their capacity to establish deep and profound bonds and connections in friendship strengthens all intimate bonds. When we see love as the will to nurture one's own or another's spiritual growth, revealed through acts of trust, care, respect, knowing, and assuming responsibility, the foundation of all love in our life is the same. There's no special love reserved for romantic partners. Genuine love is the foundation of our engagement with ourselves, with family, with friends, with partners, with everyone we choose to love. Here then I talk again about this privileging of romantic relationships and how part of the sort of what I call new visions that I'm trying to explore in my discussions of love is what would it mean for us as a culture to no longer raise romantic love as the only relevant love? and to begin to talk about the fact that indeed what makes love work with your child, with anyone in your life, is the same foundation that is needed in romantic relationships within a loving community. We sustain ties by being compassionate and forgiving. Eric Butterworth's Life is for Loving includes a chapter on love and forgiveness. Insightfully, he writes, we can't endure without love, and there's no way to the return of healing, comforting, harmonizing love than through total and complete forgiveness. If we want freedom and peace and the experience of love and being loved, we must let go and forgive. Forgiveness is an act of generosity. It requires that we place releasing someone else from the prison of their guilt or anguish over our feelings of outrage or anger. By forgiving, we clear a path on the way to love. It's a gesture of respect. True forgiveness requires that we understand the negative actions of another. While forgiveness is essential to spiritual growth, it doesn't make everything immediately wonderful or fine. I talked in this piece, and Mario, who came up to me earlier as a student here in California, and he said to me that he had read the really vicious critique of my work that who had been my one-time friend and comrade, Michelle Wallace, wrote about me a few years ago in The Voice. And when this particular piece came out, I had just recently lost my dear friend, the poet Essex Hemphill, to AIDS, and before him, Marlon Riggs, the filmmaker. And when I heard that this piece was so trashing, I felt that I didn't want to read it. And I was so struck by the number of people who were pissed off with me that I didn't want to read it, and they kept calling me up, and they said, you know, this person is ruining your career, you've got to read this. And I was like, no, I mean, why do I want to take in this toxicity? This is someone whose work I love. This is someone that I think is an especially insightful feminist thinker. And this is where Buddhism is often helpful. I knew that if I read this writing, it would penetrate my ego, and that instead of, when I heard this person's name, instead of thinking about what an insightful writer she is, I would be thinking about, oh, that bitch that wrote that really, you know, horrible piece about me. And I actually wanted not to enter that space. And we have not spoken to each other for many years since that piece. And she called me just a few weeks ago to say to me that she wanted to say to me that she was sorry that she had written that piece, that she knew that it was not a just piece of writing. And I was very moved by this. And I told people about it, and a lot of people said, oh, who cares about her calling you? She wrote that piece for all the world to hear and see. If she wants real, you know, forgiveness, she should publish something. And, you know, I, of course, would be delighted if she published something, because she did write that piece to the world. But at the same time, I was deeply moved by the fact that she called me and acknowledged and made amends. Because I feel that forgiveness is important. And I say here, her critiques were full of lies and exaggerations. I had been a loving friend, and her actions caused me heartbreak. To heal this pain, I entered into an empathic identification with her so I could understand what might have motivated her. Through the practice of compassion and forgiveness, I was able to sustain my appreciation for her work and cope with the grief and disappointment I felt about the loss of this relationship. Practicing compassion enabled me to understand why she might have acted as she did and to forgive. Forgiving means that I'm able to see her as still a member of my community, one who has a place in my heart should she wish to claim it. We all long for loving community. It enhances life. But many of us seek community solely to escape the fear of being alone. Knowing how to be solitary is central to the art of loving. When we can be alone, we can be with others without using them as a means of escape. One of my other sort of spiritual mentors in my life has been the Jesuit theologian Henry Nouwen. And in one of his books about solitude, he writes, loneliness is one of the most universal sources of human suffering today. And yet he contends no friend or lover, no husband or wife, No community or commune will be able to put to rest our deepest cravings for unity and wholeness. He suggests that we put these feelings to rest by embracing our solitude, by allowing divine spirit to reveal itself there. The difficult road, he writes, is the road of conversion, the conversion from loneliness into solitude. Instead of running away from our loneliness and trying to forget or deny it, we have to protect it and turn it into a fruitful solitude. When children are taught to enjoy quiet time, to be alone with their thoughts and reveries, they carry this skill into adulthood. Moving from solitude into community heightens our capacity to fellowship with one another. Through fellowship, we learn how to serve one another. Service is in another dimension of communal love. At the end of her autobiography, The Wheel of Life, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross confesses, "I can assure you that the greatest rewards in your whole life will come from opening your heart to those in need. The greatest blessings always come from helping." I say here that I think many of us see sacrificial love in our lives from women. And the sacrificial love, I don't mean a sentimental masochistic caring of others. I mean the truly stupendous and grand sacrificial love that women give is often taken for granted in our society, and yet I feel women have a great deal to teach us about the practice of generosity and love. And it always fascinates me that so many of the people bow down to, like Thich Nhat Hanh or the Dalai Lama, these people who are men that I think who are such wonderful men. But there are also all these wonderful women that I think are so awesome around the world that people wouldn't think of saying, "I really need to study that woman and to learn from her and to see what has compelled so many women to choose service." And I say this because there are lots of women who are not interested in service, who even look down upon it. And I'm fascinated by women who choose to serve as part of their engagement with being loving. The willingness to sacrifice is a necessary dimension of loving practice and living in community. None of us can have things our way all the time. Growing up and giving up is one way we sustain commitment to collective well-being. Writing about the need to bridge the gap between rich and poor, Martin Luther King preached, "All men and women are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects us all indirectly. This gulf is bridged by the sharing of resources." And here I go on to talk here about what does it mean to think about how we share resources? How do we challenge class elitism through the practice of love? And I'm going to read this closing paragraph and then we can talk. "Whenever we heal family wounds, whether through blood kin or chosen kin, we strengthen community. Doing this, we engage in loving practice. We choose to love because love lays the foundation for the constructive building of global community. We choose to love in ways that enable us to love the stranger. The love we make in community stays with us wherever we go. And with this knowledge as our guide, we make any place we go a place we can return to love." Thank you. So now we have lots of time. We have almost 40 minutes for questions. I would like people to frame short questions. If you go on too long, I'll try to tenderly and compassionately cut you off. And we won't have to see the violent bell hooks or something like that. Go ahead. Your name? David, for purposes of taping, I will no doubt poorly re-paraphrase your question, or so bear with me on that. If I understand you correctly, you're asking me if I think that the demise of the nuclear family makes people less loving? No? Well, actually, I would say just the opposite, that, you know, when people lived in extended families, that people had often to develop a certain qualities of compassion and recognition of people who are different like themselves. And also one of the things that I think as a child abuse survivor, as a child coming out of dysfunction, that when you're in extended family, you have much more likelihood of finding what Alice Miller called an enlightened witness. There's, you know, there may be one loving person in the midst of the 20 unloving people, and that one person's love of you, their unconditional regard of you, can be redemptive for you. But if you are just trapped, I mean, when I see, for example, kids that are trapped with one or two extraordinarily abusive, dysfunctional families, and they have no contact with anybody else, hardly, because of the privatized nature of parenting in our society, I feel for them, because I know that their potential for rescue is much less likely than if they operated. And this is, I want to say to you, is particularly true of children who are adopted from many third world countries and brought to the U.S. Because think about those children. They have no one who is at all familiar beyond that one person that may have adopted them. And often they have no one who's coming to check on them to see if that person is treating them well. It also, I think about them a lot and think about the awesome sense of, especially many of them who are people of color who have been chosen by an individual white person, and that they may have nothing in their world that validates and intervenes on. And in my book about love, I talk a lot about how single parents can choose other individuals who will be witnesses for them, so that if they are encroaching upon the rights of children, there can be someone who can say, well, wait a minute. And I give the example of one of my friends I saw throwing a lamp at her kid, and I was like, whoa, wait a minute, you know, what's going on here? And there can be a mediation of that. But often, I mean, I think urge us to think about children. This, I won't be so long in other answers, but one of the chapters in this new book that has been very controversial for people has been the chapter on children. While I raise the question, what are we teaching children about love? What are we teaching children about how to choose love? And a lot of what we're teaching children is that we can really be mean and abusive to them and say we still love them. And, or that they belong to us, and we can do with them whatever. And that particular chapter says, you know, there can be no love without justice. And until we begin to see children as requiring justice in the dailiness of their lives, we cannot create the kind of environment where they can choose love. I won't, sometimes I digress, but other times I'll try to stay. Your name, please. Susan wanted to know why it is that many of us experience being loved initially as children, then having that love taken away. Well, I was given a talk recently where I don't have any children, but where I said, I'd have had a child in a minute if they wouldn't become teenagers. And see, one of my theories is that many, many people love to have babies. And babies can bring such an element of joy. But babies tend not to be small children, willful in the extent, like I was saying to my friend Michelle this morning, you know, 12-year-olds now can kill you. You know, they can not just talk back to you, they can destroy you, but if you can have a 5-year-old or 4-year-old that you can cuddle and that you have this kind of autocratic power over, you can have a certain kind of relation. And I think many parents stop a certain kind of loving care for children as children begin to develop the kind of will where we can be defiant, where we can be critics, where we can question their hypocrisy. You know, one of the things that I remember most about girlhood is questioning and being slapped down. Questioning, but you told us to tell the truth, and then being stopped in those ways. And I think this happens to a lot of people within families. People simply not knowing how to deal with, you know, the big questions that children ask of us. And children are so incredibly informed. You know, I'm sitting with a 10-year-old, and she says to me, you know, I've decided I'm bisexual. And I'm like, okay. And I saw in myself a desire to not respond to the question or the sharing because it felt like it's too much. How can I deal with this? Can I bear the weight of what could be shared with me here? So part of me wanted to just play that person off, you know, and not have to deal with. I was like, so I said, oh, well, this is interesting. Was this an intellectual leap of faith? Or was this like through experience? She was like, oh, it was through experience. I kissed another girl at camp. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. Well, you know, then I tried to talk about desire, but I recognize how much we seek to avoid children when they ask us the questions that we don't feel that we have the answers, or if the questions that they ask. That incredible memoir that I read from, Never Let Me Down, is a memoir where she talks about having a brother who beat her throughout her childhood. And I have been amazed by the number of women who will tell me about having a brother who like really battered them. And she talks in that memoir about finally confronting her adult mother and saying, you know, he broke body parts. I mean, how could you not know? And the mother finally goes into therapy, and what is uncovered, I mean, she goes into therapy at 60-something, and what's uncovered is that her brother beat her like that, and that she never dealt with it. So when it was happening to her daughter, she just really couldn't see it. The denial was that deep and that powerful, because not having attended to her own wounds, she was completely without the resources to attend to her own daughter's wounds. So I think some of that absenting of the love occurs, because think about it, if respect is essential to love, it comes from that Latin word meaning to look at, to recognize. If you cannot look at yourself, then how can you look at your child when that child is questioning you in the depths of your being? I mean, I think it's very profound. It's why good parenting should be revered much more than we as a culture revere it, because it's not an easy task. Another question. Yes, your name? And talking to Pima Chodron, who's one. I think there are so many women in womanist theology, Katie Cannon, and just so many other women, that it's hard to make just kind of one list, but I feel that there's just out there in your daily lives. I mean, part of why I didn't name women is that I think there is a woman in everybody's life in this room who, in terms of certain ways of loving, can tutor us and teach us. And this whole way we have of wanting to find somebody from the far away or the up there is a danger to us, in that we can't ignore the right here, the people that are right here. And actually, had I read all of that chapter, I would have talked about my mother and what the role that she played, because I think many of us do not acknowledge mothers who choose to give, not who give because sexism says this is their role, but who choose to give as part of being loving and compassionate. Another question over here. Yes, Vern. This is true. Vern said, maybe I mentioned that we raise unloving, successful people. Maybe we need to redefine super successful. I think that's absolutely true, that we need a varied value system for whether our life has value. And all too often in our society right now, believe you me, from going to grade schools and high schools, children and teenagers think money and power are the two things that define you as a successful person. Not love, not caring, not generosity, money and power. Third graders say to me, I tell them I'm a writer, they say, how much money do you make? They say, what kind of car do you drive? And this, for me, working in the public school systems and talking with children, is one of the most enlightening things about where our nation's values are. Because those children echo what they hear in the world at large, and both what drives their imagination, and they certainly don't hear that being a writer can bring them any kind of in touchness with a successful and meaningful life, as I didn't hear as a child. Even though they live in a culture, particularly many of the black children I speak with, where writers have have risen to great fame and enormous economic gain. But it still doesn't register as something that could give them a meaningful life, to work with words, to work with ideas. And I think that that's absolutely so. Your question, your name? Do you want me to talk about that some? I heard that question as talking about how do men know love in a society where the very definition of masculinity negates the need for men to know love? Real men don't need to know love, because they can find themselves through acts of power. So then what happens in our society when men, with men who seek to know love? Well, we know that a lot of men who seek to know love are crushed. They're crushed, and I write about them in this book, that they are often crushed as boys. They're crushed in that moment where they begin to feel, and they begin to do anything that suggests not boy. You know, I think of my own recovering addict brother, one boy in a household of six girls, and the deep concern of my father that he not be gay, and if we have to crush every emotional bone in his body so we can feel like he will never be gay, that's okay, because he'll be a man. He'll be a real man. He'll be a straight man, and we'll be happy. So that capacity to love in... I feel like whenever I talk to men, that part of what feminism has always offered to men, if they embraced it as a political ethic, is a way back to themselves, a way back to the self, and therefore a way back to love. And I feel it's such a difficult time, because when I look at movies right now, I feel so many movies are anti-males loving, and we're seeing so much more of these sort of conventional gender arrangements, and the level of the pornography of violence has intensified so many, many times over. And the sense that I often ask myself, well, what is it that says to little boys anything about how they can know love, and particularly black males? I go around this country all the time, and people start telling me about black males need these separate schools, they need this and they need that, and I say, no, I never hear anybody say black males need love, black boys need love. No, instead they act like all they need to be is little Colin Powells, and they can drop the bombs on the people in Iraq and other places, and we'll say they are successful, they are real men. You know, no one says they need Montessori schools, that they need anything other than discipline and punish. And we're supposed to believe that out of that are going to come this healthy group of black men. So that on all levels, I think this to me is a challenge. This is one of the failures of feminist thinking. And I don't. When I say feminist thinking, I don't mean women. I mean women and men who believe in feminist thinking and politics, who have failed to theorize deeply the re-socialization of boys. We can't come up with 10 feminist books for boys that are aimed at explaining to them what sexism is. There should be a book for every age group of boys, letting them know what they could do, how they can be different. You know, strategies for parents. Early on in feminism, we talked a lot about this, and then it was just kind of abandoned. And if you're following the literature of children, while there's a lot of attention on boys right now, it's very patriarchal and very, you know, I think of the book, though I think it's very positive, Lost Boys or other books, it's sort of suggesting that, well, we need to pay attention to boys, but not that we, you know, people say to me, we need fathers in the home. And I say, honey, we need loving fathers. Because if we have violent, abusive, patriarchal fathers in the home, we're not going to produce healthy boys. Healthy white boys, Asian boys, black boys, we can forget it. If we don't think about what does it mean for fathers to love, having fathers in the home will not change anything about the nature of boyhood and male violence. And this is so hard for people. I have been stunned by the number of progressive people who don't want to tackle this question of love and masculinity. Because I think we are still afraid to talk about what must change profoundly in this culture if males are to know love. If we are to create a way of talking about males that is loving, that does not deny the essential goodness of maleness. And that's been very, very hard, because patriarchal pain makes it very hard for many of us to speak positively about men in our lives. And male behavior often makes it hard. So I see this as one of the terrains of future feminist thinking, that to be able to go back. I mean, I was just with my best friend who's a working class, from a working class, white, dysfunctional, alcoholic, Irish background, and her 9-year-old boy, and she's has written a book on mothers and illicit drugs, and we were spending a weekend together, and her little boy, who's 9, has just begun to learn patriarchal abusive behavior towards women, the terrorization through silence and withholding and through dumping. And we were like thinking about, well, what can we do? Here we are, 2 grown women being terrorized by a 9-year-old boy. You know, how do we conceptualize a way where he is allowed his grumpiness, but he is not made to feel that he is entitled to dump that grumpiness on everybody else? You know, and again, think about the fact that the single mom didn't try to do it by herself. I was able to say to him, what is your problem? You know, these days, you're really unpleasant to be around. You're being grumpy, grumpy, grumpy all the time. What's up? And then we decided to try to come up with ways to get him to pause. I mean, Thich Nhat Hanh always talks about the use of a pause, to be silent, you know, for a minute, to get him to think for a minute about his behavior. What am I getting ready to say? We said, if you feel grumpy, you know, you're entitled to that feeling of grumpiness, but maybe you have to go somewhere else and be grumpy, but you can't sit amidst other people having a good time and decide, oh, I should use my grumpiness to spoil their good time. And think about how many abusive fathers in the home that's been their MO from day one. If there's a peace and harmony, let me do something to fuck it up. You know, let me smash somebody, let me beat somebody, you know, let me yell or what have you. More and more I increasingly feel that much of this behavior is learned through boy-parent interactions. And through people, as Chris suggested, rewarding that interaction as what maleness is. So unless we come up with all kinds of ways to affirm that maleness is not that. And there is nothing, while there is nothing wrong with homosexuality, the alternative to patriarchal maleness is not homosexuality. Because many homosexual men have the same violence within malehood, the same script. So being gay does not relieve you from the burden of patriarchal masculinity. It may, in fact, intensify. So all of those things have been what I feel as feminist thinkers we have failed to adequately theorize, to turn our attention to the question of masculinity again, but not in some bullshit way like Susan Faludi in her new book, Stiff, where it's like, feminism freed women if only men would come on board. I mean, masses of women are not free. Masses of women are stuck in patriarchal thinking. So what is this nonsense that we use feminism and magically freed ourselves? Why don't these sorry, pathetic, unhappy men jump on board? I mean, it's not very enlightened thinking. Because, in fact, I think it's so much harder and deeper for us to conceptualize, what does men coming to feminism look like today? We know what we thought it looked like 20 years ago. You know, all of those things, to me, are very deep questions for the millennia. And I urge all of you who are interested in this work to do what you can to rethink. I've entered this world of writing children's books, and I'm writing a new book called Grown Grump. What is it I decided to call it? Grown Grump Grumble. Because I'm trying to think about how I can speak to boys and speak to them in a different way. Your name? You think that? You get that vibe? I don't get that vibe, but it's interesting that you do. You want to speak louder? Yeah. Well, see, the thing about me, I mean, is I'm kind of like an intellectual slut. I go everywhere. You know, I have deep and profound conversations with everybody. You know, it's like I can be picked up 5 in the morning by a taxi driver who says, oh, you're the professor. I picked you up 2 weeks ago. And we take off again on the conversation about family values that we were having. I mean, one of the things that I believe is that most of us learn a lot through conversation. And despite the fact that there are let's say even if we would project that a large number of people in this room are well educated, The fact is, if you think that everybody in this room may go out tonight and have, let's say, 5 to 10 different conversations with different people, cross class, cross whether they're educated or not, to me, learning is often what takes place in those conversations. We already know that studies show that people often buy a book because not because of speeches or what have you, or book signings, but because somebody in their life says, I read this book, and it was really helpful to me. You gave testimony that your friends brought you with them here today, that you hadn't read one of my books. So I think that, one, we never have to worry about someone being on a stage like it's too elevated, because we all take the seeds of what speaks to you in this conversation to the varied conversations of your life. And whether you know it or not, when you buy something at a store, often you engage in a conversation. Whether, as Thich Nhat Hanh always says, the conversation may simply be in your presence. It may simply be how you deal with someone, so that to be dealt with compassionately. Do you know how many people wait on us daily who are not dealt with compassionately? So you may not give somebody a mini lecture on what bell hooks had to say about love and compassion, but you're stopping for a minute and being compassionate towards them may be a healing moment. I think that one of the big dangers in the United States is we have so conceptualized change as this sweeping, momentous thing that people don't see, which is, again, what people like Thich Nhat Hanh, coming from the Vietnamese experience, coming from Buddhism, Dalai Lama coming from Tibet, and the tragedies of Tibet and of colonization and imperialist war, bring us back to that notion of the little simple things we do are part of the revolution, as well as the grand moments where bell hooks can be at the LA Public Library is a profoundly grand moment. You know, but spending 2 days with a 9-year-old who's being pissy and trying to work through that and bring some love is not a grand moment, but it's still my work, both as a political being, as a compassionate being, a being of divine spirit. And I think that's what we have to recharge as a nation, that what we do in our daily life matters as much to the revolution as those moments when we go join the protest. And they're not antithetical to one another. They don't wipe out one another. This moment of being on this stage does not wipe out all the other stages, high and low, in which I'm on. My friend Michelle and I were eating at the restaurant, which is so fancy, at the hotel that the library so generously would have offered me a place to stay. And I was slept on the floor on Michelle's futon last night, and we were talking about my choice to do that rather than the luxury hotel that the library provided, another kind of stage. Had to do with our friendship. And I was telling Terry that we woke up this morning and Michelle baked cookies and we had cookies, and I said, that wouldn't have happened at the hotel. You know, that human interaction would not have happened at the hotel. So that I think that, one, when you hear speakers, you can't also infer about the various stages that they choose to operate on in life. You can only ask them. You know, I urge you to read the Dalai Lama's new book. I think it's really interesting, Ethics for the New Millennium. Your name? Okay, go ahead. Okay. Once I stop making a mess up here with this water, which I am now doing, let me hand you this so I don't get it all wet. She asked me about a book in which I have an essay, Transforming a Rape Culture, and mine is called Seduced by Violence No More. And one of the things that I tried to talk about in there was how many heterosexual women who are feminist when it comes to sex still desire the hard dick, the penis that, you know, still define male. And this goes back to Chris's question in terms of love and eroticism and desire, that we often critique patriarchal masculinity, but often when heterosexual women come to sex, the masculinity that we valorize is the very hard dick masculinity that we have critiqued in some other setting. as being detrimental to us. And what I tried to, this is a book about rape, remember, and what I tried to suggest is that if we want rape to end, one of the things that we have to do as women who are sexual with men is reconceptualize our own relationship to the penis and what we think of as a meaningful sexual contact with a man. If he doesn't have a hard penis, we can't have a meaningful sexual contact with him. And we don't talk about this. That on one hand, we're saying men should not think of the penis as a defining aspect of who they are, as a defining, as a weapon, as all of this. On the other hand, many of us get very, very depressed when the penis doesn't get hard and stay hard. And feel often as well as very attacking of men around this. And when women get together who deal with men and talk about was it good or bad, it's often defined solely not by what he said to you, not by how he treated you, not by the overall experience, but by his penis. So I'm arguing that we have to rethink that. And what we do is we think rethink other kinds of sexual, other kinds of sexual activity. I was thinking of trying. Michelle was teasing me that my mind works, that I'm often thinking four things at one time. And just then, I was trying to think of a book by a sexologist, Lenore, I'm forgetting Lenore's last name, where she talks about what it means. She works primarily with men who want to enlarge the penis through penile implants. And she tries to talk about how two different narratives come in, what women desire who are coming in for counseling, who often don't want the hard, hard penis that the men desire, and how you bring those two desires together. What does it mean for us as a nation to begin to conceptualize heterosexual or gay male desire? And here I like Frank O'Hara's book on desire when he tries to talk about other ways of desiring. And that's what I think, like I say, would say to young people, think about what are the other ways we might talk about as a fulfilling sexual encounter. You know, how much do we affirm men when they don't try to get into our pants on a date or on a what have you? I mean, how many times have I sat around with women who say, oh, it was so great, he didn't try to do this. We don't say that. We say, do you think he's gay? He didn't try to rape me on the first date. You know, he didn't try to have sex again with me against my will. He said it was okay that we stop. I mean, because it was hurting me. And I talk about that in my piece, that when I was involved with this man and he did things like that, everybody in my life said, girl, you know he has to be gay. You better watch. We hope you're looking out for AIDS, you know, like only gay people get AIDS, which is another big myth. You know, but it's interesting, again, how it becomes hard for us to reconceptualize. Reconceptualizing might just be coming up with rituals of regard, of sexual regard, that deflect away from the penis. I want to be with you, be fulfilled, spend the night, touch you, but not, you know. It can be mutual masturbation if you want that as a deflection away from penetration. It can be all of these things. I wrote this piece in Shambhala-san on penis passion, which you might look at because I talk a little bit more about even how we talk about the penis. Are there ways of us talking about it that are not around hardness, penetration? It was very, very hard to come up with a language from either queer theory, queer vernacular, or straight culture, or celibate culture, where the penis was not always defined of and in relation to hardness of some sort. I used a line from Emily Dickinson, where she talked about a caterpillar, and how a caterpillar feels when it's crawling on your hand, the smooth, velvety feeling of that. Okay, that was a little long. Your name? Okay, am I neglecting over here? I'm going to take this one question over here. It's harder for me to see because the lights aren't on. Your name? Well, that really question about how we can build self-love was another one of those questions that started me thinking about why choose love. Because one of the things that I found is as a black thinker, I was a decolonized black thinker in this white supremacist capitalist patriarchy. I was going around saying to people, you know, we can have self-love. And invariably, black people would stand up in audiences and say, but how do you get self-love? because we talk about it. I mean, I must tell you, when I was at that retreat with Thich Nhat Hanh, he was like getting up, he was saying all this stuff about love. And, you know, when I had been going through a deep period of anger. And when I met him, I was like, so I was crying. I was saying, like, I want to be a bodhisattva, but I'm so angry. And I'm so ashamed to have this anger. I think that the same thing happens around self-love, that we hear people talk about self-love, but many of us go home and we think, we just don't get it. We don't get how do we actually go about bringing ourselves into that space of love that allows us to work on the self, also without not being narcissistic. And part of it is that one of the things I argue in All About Love is we need clear definitions of what love is. I mean, I'm still in the struggle with my ex-boyfriend about love. My book is dedicated to him because we had these discussions for like years. Like we broke up years ago and then we're having these years of discussion about the nature of love. And this book is dedicated to him because so much of the issues that are raised, young black male, come out of our discussions. But this is being one of the deepest ones, the questions of self-love. And I find, particularly if we start with males and black males in particular, that a lot of the work of self-love does take place in the location of memory and childhood. What we are willing to understand about the imprints and the lessons that we have learned, the misguided notions about love. And Marlon and I used to have this ongoing black gay filmmaker, Marlon Riggs, argument about black men. If you know his work, he was fond of saying, you know, black men loving black men is the revolutionary act. And I used to say, bullshit, Marlon. Black men dealing with their childhoods is the revolutionary act, because you can't even get to the loving unless you're able to unpack childhood. And I urge you to read a text by a young black man on death row called Finding Freedom, which is an awesome discussion of how this is a digression, but I will share it. He talks about, in terms of thinking about black people and self-love, he's in a maximum security prison on death row. And he talks about the fact that he's in the exercise room outside the space, and all the men have their shirts off. And he happens to notice that everyone is deeply scarred, and he thought, God, we have really been in the trenches, horrible scars on their body. But as he begins to talk with the men about those scars, most of them have not come from gang warfare. They have come from childhood. They've come from abusive beatings at the hands of parental caregivers, whether biological caregivers or elected caregivers. And it's that moment when, this is Jay Jarvis Master's book, when he begins to think about his childhood and the role of child abuse and begins to do the work of self-love, which is one, that work of reclaiming who we were. You know, reclaiming the foundations, reclaiming the feeling of who you were before someone said, you're so black. You know, your skin is so black, da-da-da-da-da. Reclaiming some space before those negative messages, or reclaiming the feeling that those negative messages gave to you. So that I see the work of memory is so crucial to self-love. But then the definition, I tell this man I'm still arguing with, if we know love to be a combination of care, knowledge, commitment, respect, and trust, one thing you can ask yourself, and this is why this series is so great and questions are so great, you can ask yourself, if I apply what I know about care, knowledge, responsibility, respect, and commitment to this situation, am I being loving? You know, if you do negative self-talk to yourself all the time, it shouldn't take a genius to let you know that you're not usually being loving. That if you are reproducing the enactment of shaming, the most fundamental form of child abuse that many of us in this room have known is verbal shaming and humiliation. It is the setup for every other form of child abuse many of us have known, whether it's hitting, sexual violence, or what have you. I feel like black people are shamed by this society in the space of our blackness. You know, I went to see this new movie, Dogma, that everybody was saying was so cool and so great. And I thought, gee, there's not a black female in the entire movie. The one black character, Chris Rock, is in the same darky role that we've had to be in, minstrel, darky, funny man role that we've had to be in forever and a day. All the divine spirits just happen to be white, anybody with divine power. Even though we're told that Christ is really black, that's like a joke. And then when divine spirit comes to earth, it's the sexualized white woman. And lo and behold, what's the white woman doing? Ultimately being pregnant again. I mean, it's like, please. But as a black woman, when I see these films, I think about the genocidal, the constant genocidal assault on black women waged through mass media. We just simply aren't there. Did you see that Robert Altman film, Cookie's Fortune? Where, you know, there's the black man and all the white women are fawning over him and he ain't got no mother, no sister, no cousin, no black woman he ever relates to. He's just there in the bosom of white family as a pseudo-mammy. I mean, these are like films by sophisticated people. And once again, black women are absent. And I think about, well, what does this mean in our culture for black women, for black girls? Even in the little kid movies, black female characters tend to be absent. You know, it makes the practice of self-love necessary in a very vigilant and conscious way for certain disenfranchised groups, not just through representations, but through how do we define. We have to define those things for ourselves then. What does care look like for you? You know, when Terry read from Bone Black, Remembered Rapture, when people used to tell me I couldn't write, it was up to me to do the work of self-love that said, I don't think these people are telling the truth. I don't have to believe them. Before we started, I was telling her that people still tell me I'm writing too much, and I thought to myself, now, if I was a white man whose books were being taught at universities everywhere in this country and abroad, there's no book of mine that's gone out of print, so obviously somebody's reading them. Why do people tell me every day of the week someone informs me by letter, by what have you, that they think I'm writing too much? You know, I consider that a form of conspiracy. And that, but it affects me. So I have to come back to that conspiracy and reassure myself that writing has been a source of power, of me sharing my own intellectual wealth with others. And that's part of the work of self-love. I'm very interested in black children because I think that unfortunately, if we let people be self-hating till they're 20, the work of self-love becomes much, much, much more difficult. Some of you may have read my little children's book, Happy to be Nappy. Which I wrote about just black children. Think about the fact that there was this book, and then I'm going to close in a minute. I'll come back to the lady that I didn't catch that go around. There was this children's book that came out that was very controversial called Nappy Hair. What the mass media, the white supremacist, capitalist, patriarchal mass media told us was that stupid black parents objected to their children reading this book. Mass media never talked about the content of the book. It never had anybody go interview the parents and say, what did you not like? Now, I happen to think that the book is very violent. It's all about shaming. It's a book where the little girl is being told very negative things about herself for 20 pages or however long it is. And then at the last page, she's jumping for joy. Well, we all know that children, in fact, don't jump for joy when they're being abused verbally by other children, by parents, or self-abuse by the end of the 20 pages. And I think that the working class and poor black parents who objected to this book were right on. But when mass media took it, white supremacist, capitalist, patriarchal mass media, the focus was on the sexy white woman. If you look at the images of her that were in national magazines, Bell Hooks hasn't been in all the National Time, Newsweek, all the magazines this woman was in, she was always poised in some Playboy-like pose on a hotel bed, and it was always about how horrible these black people were that supposedly her life was threatened. We only heard that from her. We never heard from the anonymous parents at all, but the message that was sent out to the world was black parents are too stupid to know what's good for their children. When the missionary good white person is trying to bring them some help for their children, they're too stupid to congratulate and worship her. And then this book, which had died an early death, which it should have because it's not a positive book, suddenly becomes a bestseller. People run out and buy it. Everybody's talking about it. That's the success of a consumer-oriented, white supremacist, capitalist, patriarchal mass media, that it can take this piece of shit book that is detrimental to the lives of our children, that is self-hating, and bring it back and regurgitate it as something that's caring and loving that we should all be reading. And I want to say that I didn't write Happy to be Nappy in response. It had already been written. It was already in production. But part of what I tried to do in Happy to be Nappy was not do what we always do to black children, tell them how horrible they are, and then say, but there's a little goodness inside you, you know, you mean, evil, black-skinned beast. But, you know, you should dance at the end of all of that. Instead, I thought, what does it mean that to conceptualize a book where, you know, if you know the book, it says, one of the things that I have loved is kids have come up to me and they said to me, you say that our hair is like flower petals. You know, there's a line where it says, our hair is flower petally soft. You know, a halo, a crown, a covering for heads that are round. All these little things. And it's been the overwhelming response by children who've come up to me and said, no one ever said anything positive. Because telling children, you know, your hair is really bad, but we can make it nice with some cream. I mean, that is not the message of self-love. And we shouldn't laugh because a lot of well-meaning black parents feel that this is the correct approach. I even had parents at the signing say to me, but don't you think we have to say these negative things to prepare our children for the real world? And I'm like, no. I say, a child who has healthy self-esteem will be better prepared to combat racism, sexism, or any form of domination than a child who has been traumatized, no matter how successful that child may become. Think about how many really so-called successful black people still have that skin color, hair, self-hatred brooding in them. You know, despite the fact that they can go and have the $200 weave, you know, braids or a perm or what have you. That's just one example of how do we begin self-love with memory, with drawing the picture in our mind's eye of the person that we want to be, of the life that we want to have. Because then it's like we offer to ourselves the recognition, and I will close here. The heart of love is recognition, of being recognized, of being seen and loved as you truly are. And if no one else will give that to us, what I want to leave you with is you have the capacity to give that to yourself. You know, I have the capacity when I look in the mirror to say to myself all the things that I feel haven't been said to me. And while it may seem hokey, corny, what have you, the fact that I am willing to offer that to myself is the beginning of self-love. You know, so that when my hair is often out and nappy, some guy comes up to me, you know, and I'm always on the search for love, some cute-looking guy comes up to me in the airport and says, you'd be so fine if it wasn't for that hair. I can say to that person, well, actually, I really love my hair. I love the way it feels and smells. You want to come over here and feel it? You know, and so that my response is not to be shattered by the self-hate. He's trying to push at me, but that I can take it back to the self-love that I give to myself, that I like you the way you are. And it's not easy as a middle-aged woman in this society who's fatter than I might want to be or what have you. I give myself the task of what does it mean for me to go a day without self-critiquing, a day in which everything I can say to myself is affirming. I mean, think about how much negative, undermining self-talk we do. And when people say that this isn't political, black people are caught in the grips of the genocidal impact of our lack of self-love. So much so that we shouldn't even have to be talking about our children's hair and the hating each other of the color of our skin, because we should have cleaned all that up years ago. But the only way we could have cleaned it up would have been to come out of shame into self-recovery and decolonization. And we haven't fully done that as a nation, around ending racism as victims of people of color, whether we're Asian, Hispanic, because to me the category black is a political category. When we use the category black, the experiences of degradation and dehumanization that come with that affect every other group of people of color in this society. It doesn't exclude them to use the category black. It is the welcoming category because it is the category of our pain as a nation around race. We know from two nations that Andrew Hacker documents, and because he's a white man, people trust his documentation more. But what he documents is that there is a special hatred that people in this nation reserve for black people. And when other people of color, whether they're South Asian immigrants or get in out of line, they get dumped into that special hated category too. So on the tip of our love, we welcome people into that category. When I use the word black, I think I'm speaking for all the colored peoples of the world who suffer white supremacy. Because it is white supremacy that has made the category black a political category and not black people. I thank you for your warmth. I thank you for the series and hope to see you again.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the law firm Arendt Fox. Media support provided by KPCC 89.3 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.